Hi, all you Liberty lovers, and welcome to Fiendish and Friends. It's episode 10, despite what's written on Twitter, with Noel Levisa, founder and CEO of Code Valley, who joins us to talk about his work on emergent coding. This is a decentralized software development paradigm employing a type of software component that cannot be copied or reused, with the objective of achieving both workable developer specialization and a practical software components market. That was taken directly off Wikipedia. Learn what actually that all means today. As Douglas McAvoy observed way back in 1968, NATO Software Engineering Conference, the software industry is not industrialized. And emergent coding aims to change this while using Bitcoin Cash as the backbone of their payments architecture to enable it. So please welcome onto the mic, Noel. Welcome to Fiendish and Friends. It's great to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the introduction.
Thank you. So yeah, I think it's best way is to start right at the very top, because I'm guessing a lot of people here won't know what emergent coding is or anything that I've said set up so far. So in your own words, how do you pitch emergent coding to those who know nothing about it? And what solution is it offering the world?
All right, that's getting right to it. Emergent coding is actually the technology that underpins a practical software components market. A practical software components market is quite an old idea. As you mentioned, McElroy proposed it as a solution to the industrialization of software back in the late 60s. And the components market, a practical components market, is a formidable problem to solve. And it does require components that can't be copied or reused, so that you're essentially forming allowing a developer to specialize in their space, if you will, and protect their intellectual property so that they can expect repeat business. At present, if I sell you a routine or an object or a bean or a module, I'm essentially giving away my intellectual property, and I must rely on just goodwill on your part or some license agreement or the like, in order for you to not reuse that component. So emergent coding solves that problem, where now we can deliver a component into your project with the full rights. You've got the rights to reuse it as many times as you like. You won't be able to economically. So that's how the protection mechanism it works. And that ability to specialize means that you can look forward to repeat business. You can implement improvements to your component that you're selling. And we can look forward to, as a community, your component being around into the future. And that ability to protect your intellectual property, to protect your prospects of repeat business, is what underpins this practical software components market. So now your component lives in a classification and competes with other components from other suppliers in the same classification. And as you can expect, if your component is faster, lighter, stronger, cheaper, it will gain market share at the expense of the other components in that classification. So at a fundamental level, we're correcting the incentives structure for software that are basically being bypassed because of our inability to specialize, if you will. And so by correcting that specialization, we make possible a practical software components market. And if you can imagine that level of competition that's occurring in each classification, you're basically setting the scene for a fast path for improvement across the board, just like in any other industry, where if I can make a better widget, I can increase my market share at the expense of other suppliers. So a practical software components market, to answer the second part of your question, is really aiming at producing all software for all platforms. It is a general purpose tech. It's a new way of producing software. Like I said, it just corrects those incentive structures. It allows software developers for the first time to specialize. And that specialization means that we are building software in a decentralized manner. Instead of one developer building many thousands of features into a project, a developer now builds a single feature into many thousands of projects. So that specialization has a lot of advantages and a lot of challenges. Like, one of the most formidable challenges, in addition to just protecting the intellectual property, is how do you pay thousands and thousands of contributors spread across 150 countries around the world for each project? So this decentralized software tech, it was an absolute gift when, you know, Satoshi came up with cryptocurrency, with, you know, the original Bitcoin, which was a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. Such a decentralized payment system is absolutely, you know, you can't get a better match for a decentralized software development system. You know, I often sort of say that the heavens opened and a monetization scheme descended that was, you know, just exactly what you, what you could ever have hoped for in order to implement a practical software components market that can tie together, you know, 30 million software developers around the world into a single cohesive unit.
Yeah, and that is a topic that I definitely want to explore a bit more with you. You know, just a disclaimer there. So I know Noel. We've known each other for several years. We've actually spent some time with each other at the BCH 2022 conference in St. Kitts and Nevis. So I'm aware of his passion for Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, and the importance of this to his project, and I really would like to delve into that a bit further. So, just going back to what you said there, so I think that was really really nicely said, and I think it explains very well what emergent coding is doing, what it offers, you know, and to sort of prescribe it to an analogy. So if you look at a car manufacturer, whether it's a Tesla, whether it's a BMW, whether it's Volvo, the car manufacturer, like in any industrialized process, they're not making everything. They're not making the components. They're not making the nuts and the bolts, and they're not making the tires. You have thousands of different companies and enterprises that are working in a free market system, and they're all specialized doing what they do really well, making that nut, making that screw, making that gear. And they then sell that to those components to the car manufacturing company, and they put that all together. And this specialization is what allows incredibly refined and efficient and cheap parts, because the incentives are correct. And in the end, you still end up with incredibly complicated machines. You know, cars today are, you know, have more lines of code than most of us can write. Very, very complicated machines with lots of electronics and lots of components. And that's the end result. And with emergent coding, as I understand, it's essentially looking to bring that idea and that model of industrialization to the software market, so that people can specialize on their particular tools, their agents, and then allow this to be sent to the construction area, the construction site, where then someone else can create their car, as it were, the piece of software, the whatever it is that they need to be running, but in a way that protects the original creator of those products. It can't just be their work and effort isn't immediately copied and reused. Would you say that analogy is that correct? Could you improve upon it?
No, that goes to the heart of it. The fundamental basis for emergent coding, that the big change that is made, and Fred Brooks has mentioned in the that something essential has to change if we're going to fix, you know, the problems with software, certainly to allow specialization, something essential. And the essential thing that we've changed is that we've actually reversed the integration responsibility. And this has massive ramifications. It is essential, absolutely essential change that we made. And reversing the integration responsibility. So traditionally, I would create a component, stick in a library, and you would access that library and integrate that component into your project. With emergent coding, it's me, the creator of the component, that is integrating my component into your project. So it's actually reversing that integration responsibility, because part of the information that you require to integrate my component into your project is, you know, knowledge about my component. That's my intellectual property. And so how is it that I can sell you a component and tell you and not tell you how to use it? So that was like the fundamental change that had to be made. If we reverse the integration responsibility, instead of me giving you a component, you give me a construction site. And by reversing that integration, I get to protect my intellectual property. You still get the benefit of the component built into your project. And by making that reversal, I can, who knows better how to integrate my component into your project than me, the author of this particular component. And so this reversal is a very big change, has huge ramifications. This, you know, construction site thing that I'm talking about, the construction site, when you give me the construction site and a little bit of Bitcoin Cash, I can then create my component into your project. And that construction site allows me behind the scenes to partition that construction site, to subcontract other components from other suppliers. So basically making my component as an assemblage of smaller components from other suppliers, like in any other industry. And this allows these components to properly scale all the way up and all the way down. So when we scale all the way down, we basically no longer need a high-level language or a compiler. You know, that's just services incorporated into those smaller components. And at the upper level, we can have components that are very powerful, you know, are delivering quite complex features into your project. And essentially, this is how the industry, we're seeing parts of this already. We call them domain-specific languages and the like. So these high-level components that scale up at the high levels of abstraction are essentially like domain-specific components that are really not so much about designing code into your project, but really capturing your requirements that you want to create your application out of. You want this, you know, this feature, this feature, this feature. So you will choose the corresponding components to create those features into your project.
Yeah, this is a paradigm shifting tool. You can see, I think anyone that's listening can see its potential. And it really goes down to seeing this in action. How is it actually working? How easy is it to achieve the goals that is set out? So I understand. So right now, actually just back it up a bit, just to think about the scale of this this effort and this undertaking, because it is paradigm shifting. It's changing the entire paradigm of the software industry, and flipping the sort of, as you say, it's like flipping it around completely about how you actually organize that software and project creation. Code Valley dates back. So the company was founded in 2000. So 25 years ago, 25 years this year, which first of all, that's, you know, that is an incredible time for a company to exist, you know, without a public product release, which I think goes to show, you know, you must have some very committed investors, right? This is something that people are very interested in. You've got some, you know, there's a lot of time there. So what was the bulk of that 25 years taken to do? Like what has taken that time and the bulk of that time to get where we're at today?
No, that's an awesome question, and the way we went about solving this problem, like just fixing specialization, doesn't give you a components market, you know. So one of the early, the first things that fall out of that reversal, that specialization, is that these components no longer have a runtime interface. There is no runtime interfaces, and so the components that we created, we can't draw upon the beautiful libraries and all the work that's been done to date, because these components now essentially have a design time interface. At design time, we're contracting you for your component, and your runtime interface is actually part of the design as you build it into my project. You know, the runtime interface is essentially seamless. It's seamless. The component is seamlessly integrated. So part of that big delay, part of that huge gestation period is two major efforts. One is we just didn't know what these components would be like. You know, where are the interfaces at design time between these components? And those sorts of questions only come about through lots and lots of experience. But the real killer, you know, the real thing, you know, that took enormous amounts, sums of money and effort, has really been our goal to you know, we wanted the integrity of fielding a system that was built with the system. So we wouldn't have any legs to stand on if we said, all right, we want you to build your component server with, you know, Ruby or something. We needed to build the entire infrastructure for this software components market with this software components market. And so we had to tease out north of 5,000 components, build and field and test them all, so that, you know, using, you know, we had the bootstrap, so we had to use conventional programming languages initially, until we had enough components that we could then build components. And so this became the big time consuming effort. We wanted the integrity of having the system built with the system. So we perhaps could have went to market a lot sooner, but now, you know, what integrity would we, how would we fare in the market if, you know, all right, we want you to build this very sophisticated component server that can accept a payment and construction site can subcontract and can, you know, collaborate with peers and when you're collaborating with peers, you know, arriving at decisions that that comply with everybody, agreements, and so forth, and do all that automatically. You're talking about a very, very sophisticated piece of software. And so we actually have this mountain of components across four levels of abstraction that can build your, you know, presence in the marketplace so that you can supply your components into the market. The system is completely decentralized and it's completely non-custodial. So, you know, your components, you know, the only presence in the market that your customers see is just in the catalog, as a reference in the catalog. But as you understand, you're actually designing your component into everyone's project. And so there's a fair bit of infrastructure at your end to support your component. And so really it's those two factors that have really cost enormous amount of time to create essentially the first practical software components market. And, you know, there are some huge advantages to that. You know, just that integrity is the most important thing that we were chasing. Yeah.
I think that's a really fair point. If you're not using your software to create the software, then what integrity would you have? So this is a the biggest challenge that you had, and this is I understand. Then this is what took the bulk of that time to get to the stage where you're at now. But you are now in testing. So in 2023, you released this opened for businesses to be testing on this. So we're now into the second year, or 2025 now. And yeah, I'd love to know. So first of all, I mean, what you just said there actually is kind of interesting, because in my mind, what I was imagining that emergent coding would be very useful and certainly at the start for creating highly efficient code, highly efficient binary code where memory constraints are important. But it sounds like the scope is actually already much wider than that right from the get-go. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned from the get-go, you know, the tech is really it's really a replacement, really, for the current software system. You know, it's designed to produce all software for all platforms. I've actually had a conversation with Doug McElroy about this, and when he proposed it in 1968, how is it that the solution to specialization eluded him, especially when the incredible brains that were at that conference — it's a NATO conference in Germish, Germany at the time — and they were tasked with finding a way to solve the software crisis at the time. NATO being a military organization, the largest software projects at the time, probably like today, are military projects. And so there was a lot of cost overruns and schedule overruns, like there are with software today. It's, software is a formidable problem to big projects, fare worse. And asking him about what, why wasn't this reversal, this solution to specialization, why wasn't it found, discovered at that time, especially with the brains in that room? I've got theories. He's got theories, and one of the theories is that the high level languages that were invented at the time were invented in a few years earlier, 1954, with the advent of Fortran, and such a step change it was that the high level languages were just embraced, and it was expected that any solution would involve high-level languages. And so here, if you look carefully, we're reversing the integration responsibility to create a component, essentially turning a component from a piece of code to a service, a design service, that we design that code into your project. And as a design service, we can protect your intellectual property. As a piece of code, I've got to tell you how to use it. I've got to embody that code that you can copy and use it in other projects. If I'm building that piece of code, a fragment of code into your project, then that's not readily available for you to use, even though you have the right to, in another project. You can see how that that reversal converts it from a piece of code into a service. And really, there is no where do we never pass through a compiler, we never pass through a coding stage with emergent coding. You select high level components, which is the embody the features that you want your project to do. You contract them, and they essentially return you binary that you concatenate to produce the final executable outcome. Those fragments of code were actually created by subcontractors to those prime contractors. Technically, those subcontractors also use subcontractors, and so on and so forth down the levels, many levels of abstraction. So we've got components that exist over many levels of abstraction, all the way down to, you know, a fragment of code to add two numbers together. You would think such a component would be easy to implement, but to be given a construction site, you must participate in several collaborations. You know, you'll have to participate in a collaboration for your input variables and your output result, because, you know, your piece of code has got to work with the other pieces of code that are being designed into that project at the same time. So you've got at least four collaborations. Even if you wanted to design the code just to add two numbers together, you need to participate in a collaboration on how one of those variables is going to be represented and where it's going to be, et cetera, and another variable for the two inputs. And then the output, you need to collaborate in another, participate in another collaboration and arrive at an agreement for the output variable. And of course, you need to collaborate in the construction site itself. So you've got to do a lot of work to arrive at those agreements before you can render that fragment into my project via the construction site. It essentially predates high-level languages, and there is in discussions with McElroy, it seems like that they were blinded at the time just because of the incredible performance that high-level languages were able to give them in the early stages of the software industry, and that it was just generally accepted that any solution for these reusable components things, you know, that we wanted to create had to be cast in the form of, high-level languages. And so these early attempts were like libraries of routines, you know, or objects in more recent times, or, you know, beans or the like. And so these are even components. There are many attempts at trying to solve this problem. But something essential had to change, and it's a very big change. So it does mean that there are quite a significant departure from current methods, but it eliminates enormous levels of duplication where all these different languages need these different libraries. We suffer the same thing in Bitcoin Cash, where we're beautifully decentralized with many different node suppliers, BCHN, BCHD, Flowey, Verdi, Knuth, and the like. Now, they're using different languages and different libraries and so forth. So if we were language agnostic, we could eliminate a lot of duplication. And we still get the diversity, but not from like having different node suppliers, from having different component suppliers, like the same component from several different suppliers, if you know what I mean. So we still get the diversity, but it's done properly like other industries. You know, I can buy a tire from Goodyear, and if that tire doesn't meet my requirements, I'll go to Bridgestone or the like, you know, a different supplier. And that competition over that one component means that we always get a premium quality outcome. So fixing those incentive structures. So there is some big changes that it's going to wrought. But of course, it's not because, you know, we don't have to do all this work for nothing. There are huge benefits associated with this. Correcting this incentive structure means this whole market is on a fast path for improvement. You build the same application with the same requirements tomorrow with this system, you're likely to see it being smaller, lighter, faster, stronger, because at every level of classification, at every level of abstraction, we have component suppliers competing for business. That's why building software with this technology will converge on, you know, optimal solutions which is really quite astonishing. You know, if you have a library, just the act of using, you know, a routine or an object out of a library, you're conforming to a runtime interface. You're sacrificing runtime performance for it trying to determine its runtime context. We get the runtime context at design time. We know, when this code is going to run, what it's got to do, and what it's got to work with. And so we can, these features, when they're designed into the application, can be very efficient. And, that competition will drive that efficiency over time. Quite an interesting.
Yeah, and this is something that I've heard about from developers that have taken the pilgrimage to Townsville, and they've seen emerging coding in action. They've said, some of the outputs, the creations were just mind-bogglingly small. Don't shoot me for the exact amounts, but I'm roughly in a factor of. Something that would be 500 KB that was already really small down to 50. It was just so incredibly efficient, only having because the output only does exactly what it's been told to do. So you don't have any of the libraries with that. So very interesting. What I imagine many people will have the question is, just taking everything that you said and thinking about this process of creating an output and taking that all at face value that, okay, this creates an efficient process that creates the desired output and does so in a way that protects the intellectual property of the person creating these agents and creating these components. And what I think is really interesting is thinking about the input, because for me personally, I find it very challenging to imagine how that input would be made in a way that someone can create what it is that they want to create more effectively than with code. And so on your website that you've got a screenshot showing the IDE or the software development system, is there any videos that someone could take a look at, to see how this is how this works in action, or is this something that is planned for the future?
A very interesting and a whole other field. It's quite a big question. I did allude to the upper levels of these new components, higher levels of abstraction really being there to capture requirements. Remember, these components, there's no high-level language involved. So integrating these components are not your responsibility. You're contracting somebody else to do that. And so essentially there's no glue code, which is what you would be faced with when you were conventionally integrating, library routines or the like. There is no glue code here. These components will build, they'll cooperate with each other and build their features into your project. So the input essentially the high level features that are domain specific. So we call that top level layer of components, we call it the behavior layer. And essentially that's where we're limiting our upper levels of abstraction. And so you would create an application by selecting behavior level components and putting them together. And that example that's on the website is our studio. It's a little editor that attaches to the catalog, and so you can peruse the catalog for these these components that are available. And there is essentially one line of syntax. It's not a programming language. It's a contracting language. That line of syntax defines the contractor. Fully qualifies the name and the requirements that contractor requires, including the construction site. And that document we call an expression is basically a list of those contractors and how they are expected to, the permissions for them to cooperate with one another in order to deliver your binary executable. And each of those, each line is essentially going to cost some money because you're going to be contracting somebody to perform that service. And that's one of the beautiful features of building software with you know, real components is that, okay, you look them up in the catalog and you, all right, this component's, you know, 20 cents or this component is $20 or whatever. You know, before you hit the bill button, exactly how much this is going to cost, how long it's going to take to build, what sort of resources it's going to use and what sort of performance you can expect. You know, those sorts of things are kind of upfront, like in other industries. You know, we before we purchase something or before we build something, if we know what the price of all the components are, we know pretty accurately what the total cost is. And so here we have the same advantages in building software. You would create an expression. And remember, those high-level components, they're there to win market share. And so being domain specific, if you're going to build, let's say General Protocols wanted to build their XO wallet. If you're going to build a wallet, you know, there are certain components that would be very useful for that specific kind of application, you know, and people could create components that target that kind of application, being domain specific. We are seeing vestiges of like domain specific languages in industry, and there is some advantages to that. Here, it's naturally pops out at high levels of abstraction that, you know, we can create a suite of behavior components that are targeting a specific form of application, making the expression of that application very easy to do. And if it's not easy to do, then, you know, an enterprising young man like yourself can see, hey, look, if I built like this sort of component, I can make it even easier to use for people to, you know, create an expression. You can see how you know, any impediment here, you just build another component and capitalize. If there is an impediment, you know, in the car industry at the hundreds of 100 years ago, it's a formidable task to get a spark to occur inside an engine block under extreme pressure. You know, you got to get through that engine block somehow, and with a wire that can't be blown out from the pressure, and create the spark at the right time. And, an enterprising individual come up with an idea for, hey, I'm going to create a bolt. It's going to have a screw thread, making it really easy. But this bolt is going to have like an insulated core, and we're going to call it a spark plug. And it can easily be added to the engine. I'm going to solve everybody's problem. Overnight, this guy sold thousands of spark plugs, and everybody switched from 30 different methods of trying to get a spark into an engine block to just buying this guy's, spark plug, which solved the problem kind of cleanly. So the same thing here, you know, these domain specific components, we can expect to see domain specific components pop up for every kind of application and software type that exist. You know, there is hundreds of thousands of different software types. So we can expect, you know, domain-specific suites of behavior agents for each of those software types to make it effortless for somebody to come along and, they've got an idea for some software and they've got a checkbook or some Bitcoin Cash, and they can readily create software to realize their idea.
Okay, cool. That's fantastic. And that's actually a good point, a good point to go on to the question that I had. So just thinking about what domain-specific components are already available, because as I said, this has been now in testing. So I understand that several companies are using this in the testing phase. And I'd just like to know, like, Are we already seeing that? Are they just using the components that already been built to compile what they need, or are they actually already starting to create these the components themselves as a requirement for their projects? And also, I'd love to hear about how is that testing going, and what's the feedback from the people that are using this, and are you happy with the results so far?
Well, technically we're still, in stealth mode, but I, it's a very big project, and it spanned, decades and tens of millions of dollars in investment. The market itself really consists of like two pieces of software, essentially. One piece of software is what we call Studio, and it's really the product that we sell. Studio allows people to access the catalog and lay up these expressions and build them, so manage the build process and return the binary executable. So Studio, it's quite a sophisticated piece of software, as you can imagine. And the other piece of software is an agent. You referred to it earlier. An agent is what a developer would field on their hardware. Where and they would create the agent, which would allow that developer to accept, many contracts simultaneously. So essentially, an agent can be thought of as a component server, even though this is, it's a service that's being provided. So as I mentioned earlier, a developer moves from building many thousands of features into a single project to building a single feature into many thousands of projects. This is the idea of specialization. And so the practical software components market merely consists of, millions of these agents distributed around the world, and these studio applications to allow people to use those components that are fielded by those agents. And that the catalog is also distributed. So each agent, we use technology to Kademlia to distribute the catalog. So the community itself is hosting the catalog, and it's integrated into each agent and each studio application. And that's been that's quite those two applications. Represent the entire market. How the entire they represent that is the entire market. So the essentially component servers, the catalog, and a studio, which is tied together. And because the agents are hosted by their respective owners, the developers, that's why it's completely non-custodial. Their intellectual property of how they're component works stays on their machine and is only accessible as a service. Their wallet, for payment, etc., is on their machine. It's there isn't, and they're hosting a little bit of this international catalog, where their particular component would be listed in a particular classification at a particular abstraction, along with all their competitors. And so that's the kind of the structure of it from testing. For testing purposes, we had to create, several thousand components to at several different levels of abstraction to be able to build Studio, to be able to build an agent. And so a developer wishing to participate in this components market, they need to build an agent and run it on their software. But we have a beautiful system which has, several thousands of components, including a suite of behavior components that are purposefully designed to create agents. These are agents that can create agents, and this is part of that integrity issue that we spoke about earlier. And so here, a developer wishing to create a component and participate. Merely has to express the high-level requirements, and we've got domain-specific components for that. The sorts of things that you would need your agent to do. We've got components that can design those features. And so you, theoretically, you could express the requirements for your agent, submit it to this community, and in a few minutes, receive a binary executable that would perfectly be compatible with the rest of the community. You would then run up that agent on your hardware, make sure you test those services, and then you would just register that agent with the catalog, and the agent has already got the catalog built into it because it's decentralized. And so it's a matter of just participating in that, in that data structure, that global data structure, by publishing its design time interface. Essentially, it's like a business card for that particular component, and now it's accessible to the rest of the world, and it can begin, generating income within minutes of joining the community. So testing has really been a huge effort. We have what we call a rake. We can rebuild our entire portfolio of components by submitting the new requirements to the existing community of agents, and they will build a new generation. So if we need a feature to be added, especially in these early days where we're not on the market yet, if we want to add a new feature, let's say we want to put a balance sheet and a profit and loss, an income statement in the console tab of your agent, so that you can look at your financial performance of your component, we would just create those agents and just do another rake. And now every agent has this finance tab built into their console. So the testing has been this process of raking new revisions as we approach the reliability and performance and the features that we desire of the starting market, if you will. We do have a small number of technology partners that have their own components that are part of this early system. And we have, as you mentioned, we did some tests way back in 2016 using Bitcoin when it was still electronic cash. And back in 2016, we had a centralized version of the components market. And we built up a capability to a point where we could actually create individual agents. And so we then decentralized. And so now we have a fully decentralized software components market that is created by this large group of software agents that we've had to build, identify, build, test, and deploy, and get them stable enough that we can build an application from millions of contracts reliably. It's a formidable challenge. And the payment system, of course, and I'd like to talk about that after I finish this question, but the payment system too is a formidable challenge. And but coming back to testing in a decentralized manner with a payment machinery, we did deploy a market internally in late 2023. And we did spend last year adding essential features. We were using the components market prior to 2023 without payment machinery. So these agents would work for free. It's not a form that would be practical. If you're going to build a component, you want to get paid for it. So the payment layer is a recent development, and it has been a formidable challenge to get the payment machinery in there to make millions of payments, very tiny payments, international, small payments reliably. Each agent has to have a wallet. Each agent receives payments. Each agent must make payments. You know, so you can imagine there's a ton of machinery inside an agent just for the.
A ton of machinery, and also imagine a ton of bandwidth. So I think, you know, just to make it clear for everyone. So Noel was using BTC, so the original, the original chain Bitcoin before any forks, or before the notorious forks and the block war, was using BTC for these payment systems. But of course, you know, as Noel alluded to, which everyone in the community is aware of, because of increased usage without increasing the size of the blocks, which was always planned by the original developer, the founder of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, this wasn't increased, which caused a lot of problems for you, as I understand, because this was, you know, handling this sort of bandwidth of transactions, this isn't something that Visa or MasterCard it can do because of the low amounts of the money that's being transferred to Visa and MasterCard, especially then, but still true today, was really only sort of affordable when you're talking about, you know, whether it's 50 cents or a buck or something much higher. And of course, then you have the problem of exchange rates in different countries and legal liability. There's a, you know, if you're facilitating fiat, especially across borders, across countries, there's a lot of risk there. With fraud and cashbacks as well as everything else. So a sort of a decentralized working payment system needed to be there. That was Bitcoin. BTC didn't work out. For whatever reason, there's a whole books are written about that. And then you moved it. So of course there was the forks that happened. There was the Bitcoin Core continuing its way with SegWit, and we had Bitcoin Cash continuing its way on the original strategy of P2P Cash for the world. What made you choose Bitcoin Cash? What properties did it have that you thought, hey, this is in all of the crypto world, or with all the possibilities that I have in fiat with Visa, with MasterCard, and all these different payment systems, what made you choose Bitcoin Cash, which you use to this day?
That is such a good question. You know, back in the day, there was only Bitcoin. And in 2016, Bitcoin had already been taken over, but it was still practical. You could still use it as a medium of exchange. When it did get full blocks and it stopped working as a medium of exchange, it's not so much that it stopped working. They didn't want you to use it as a medium of exchange. And so here, with this tech, we really needed that medium of exchange. So, you know, we were involved in trying to win back the hijacking, to get rid of the hijackers. We participated in Bitcoin XT, Bitcoin Unlimited, Bitcoin Classic. You know, these were attempts to regain control of Bitcoin, and it was pretty bleak. Crypto can be thought of as a solution looking for a problem, and we genuinely have an industrial problem that is such a good match for cryptocurrency as a medium of exchange. We have our software development tech, and crypto is software. It's completely virtual. It can be completely implemented in software. It's such a perfect match, and we have a decentralized system, and it's peer to peer. It's such a good match. So when I can remember, there were very dark days because I wasn't aware of the work being done to split Bitcoin Cash from Bitcoin, and I can recall in mid-July, SegWit was going to be activated in a couple of weeks, and you know, I've got no solution for this tech. I've got no solution for this tech, and Bitcoin Cash popped up. You know, it was as a project 2 weeks before SegWit was going to activate, and the first I heard of it, Omri Sachet, he never finished the sentence, and I was on board. Like I needed the original Bitcoin, which is what Bitcoin Cash is today. I need that original Bitcoin. And we've actually taken it a lot further. Not only is Bitcoin Cash perhaps the closest humanity has come to inventing ideal money, but it's got a lot of other properties that make it, you know, very suitable, very ideal for global money. You know, not least of which is its governance model, which is miles and miles ahead of like any other coin. But it also has really advanced features, and we're using some of those features, you know, in terms of, you know, smart contracting and the like. We make extensive use of payment channels. So we're not only using a leading coin, we're using the leading tech on that leading coin, and we're using a leading, you know, software development tech to implement it all. It is very, very exciting space to be in. These payment channels, as you can imagine, these components are made of smaller components. And so each business of producing a component has long-term relationships with other businesses for those smaller components that they subcontract. And those business relationships, they would be long-term, because if I'm going to subcontract you for a component that it gets embodied in my component, you're representing my reputation. If I'm choosing a bad component, it's not reflecting on you, it's reflecting on me. You know, I think the Ford Motor Company back in the late 80s did a recall in North Queensland because a Bosch relay in their car wasn't spec'd correctly, and you could be driving down the outback at high speed at the middle of the night, and boom, there goes your headlights. And you know, Bosch created the faulty relay, but it was Ford that took the hit. You know, they did the recall, and it was their reputation that got tarnished. And so these long-term relationships are really important to establish, because, you know, you want to present the most, you know, highest quality component to your suppliers to win market share. Then you must use, you know, high quality materials like in any other industry. So it's your choice of subcontractor is very important. If you've qualified a subcontractor, you want to stick with them, even if there is perhaps other suppliers that can supply the same part that you are supplying me. I would still stick with you. You're qualified, you know, and if it got to a level where, gosh, you know, they're like half price or something, I say, look, you know, gee, Fiendish, you know, we've done a lot of business together, but, you know, your competitor here is at half price. You know, can you sharpen your pencil for me? You know, I'd still want to work within our relationship, as in any other industry. Those reputations are important, and those reputations are perfectly matched for payment channels. And so here we can use a payment channel where we can elevate payments that are too small to operate in the Bitcoin Cash, you know, payment system. And we can elevate them into a payment that's large enough to be on chain. So we're tapping into a whole payment channels allow us to open a whole other part of the economy to on-chain payments, you know. So this is very exciting, and the properties of payment channels are just extraordinary, because you create an escrow where both the supplier and the client have signing rights. So the supplier can never be duped. You can never make a double spend, because your supplier actually has a say in creating the transaction. So they would never, you know, dupe themselves. So there is just zero chance of a double spend with a payment channel. And you can have any level of protection, because the escrow can be done offline. You know, it can be done weeks before. We can have 1,000 confirmations on the escrow. And then we can do as a payment to you, irreversible cash, as quickly as I can sign a datagram. That makes each of these payment channels exceed the capacity of all the world's, you know, credit card companies combined. You know, we can do millions of transactions in a payment channel, you know, per second, effortlessly, because it only represents two transactions on the blockchain, one to open the channel and one to close it at the end of the day.
Actually, yeah, that's a really interesting point, just thinking about emergent coding when this does have a public release and its effect on the chain. So what you just said there alludes to it is the fact that actually, even though it might be millions of payments via the payment channels, in the end, that would be two transactions. So very, very scalable, which is fantastic for your business, fantastic for people using it. It's very, very low cost, which means that the developers or the creators of these components gets to keep their money as opposed to it to go to other things. Just thinking about that in respect to BCH. So if everyone looks onto the BCH network, it's possible to see number of transactions. And we can see there that there have been some incredible spikes since 2023. So the base level somewhere between 11,000 and 15,000 transactions per day. But then suddenly there are these spikes that last for one, sometimes 2 days, that have taken that base level and, you know, 10x'd it or much more than that. And a lot of this activity is attributed to emergent coding. So maybe, you know, just understanding what you've been saying there, it sounds like the emergent coding wouldn't actually generate such a huge number of transactions. So what was the cause of the spike of transactions in these times?
Yeah, no, excellent question. I did the calculations late last year, and emergent coding was responsible for something north of 6% of all transactions on the Bitcoin Cash blockchain worldwide last year. And yes, there were some huge, huge spikes. So coming back to, if you can just look at the market again, you have a component supplier. He has 5 or 10 subcontractors. Well, that component supplier would have a payment channel to each of its clients, as well as payment channels to each of its suppliers. Now, when the market is operating, we've got thousands of components in operation. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of payment channels in operation at any given moment. Now, when we are doing testing, you know, we need to boot this components market into life, and that means we establish large numbers of payment channels. Now, if we need to, for test purposes, we need to shut the market down, then we need to close a lot of these. So 150,000 payment channels, yeah, we might need to close. So what we were, you know, during testing, we were generating large numbers of transactions as we were creating, you know, booting the market, and large numbers again when we would close the market for whatever purpose. If we had a new revision or something like that, we'd restart. When it's in operation, you know, it would never be shut down. Each component can be, you know, replaced live. You know, it might be hosting 100,000 contracts, and it will be, we have a method where we can, you know, upgrade your version. You know, you can build a smarter, lighter, faster, stronger version and bring across the contracts that are currently in flight. So part of the testing it has inflated the numbers, like you said. There are a much more larger number of actual transactions last year, but principally that was because we were starting and stopping the components market for whatever reason, as we were adding features or testing, you know, improving performance or the like. So
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. So we're just thinking about, like, the so you've got a few hundred thousand channels, as I understand, today. What sort of length? When do those channels need to close? Is this something that can stay open for a year, or is it a shorter schedule?
Good question. And really, that's really up to the individual developer. As you can imagine, we have components that exist over many levels of abstraction. And if you're having a supplier, at a certain level of abstraction, you have certain suppliers at a lower level of abstraction, your income is essentially the cost of goods. So your contracts to those suppliers, and you would add a margin, so typically we would operate with a 20% gross margin. And so your price that you would list in the catalog would essentially give you, 20% return on any contract that you receive, because you'll be spending 80% of that contract fee with your suppliers. And the payment channels, you can put, it's up to you how many payments you can put into a channel. You can open a channel. There are two parameters there: the number of payments in a channel and the length of the channel, the time that the channel operates over. And so during testing, we might run channel lengths of only a single day to maybe a week. But when the market is operational, it's up to developers. Having a channel operational for, say, a month can really cut your costs. But you're not, only when that channel closes does that money get freed up into your wallet. And so you can cut costs, reduce costs and reduce the fees. But you don't have access to those funds until the channel actually closes. So I could probably run a channel over 3 or 4 days, but I'm paying a higher percentage in fees, but I get access to that money sooner. From an accounting purpose, in the channel, when a payment is made, the instant I send you that datagram, I can never get that money back. Like, that is irreversible. You've got the transaction. There is nothing I can do to get that money back. So from an accounting perspective, the payment in the channel, even though it hasn't settled on chain, is when it's considered that you're being paid, because that's the irreversible event, if you know what I mean.
That's really interesting. So it sounds like it might be then kind of tricky to say on public release, so that when this is being in the hands of people and people can come to you and use this tool, pay for this tool, it would be impossible to say sort of what sort of transaction level it would be. It really depends then on everyone that is using this and how often they want to open and close the channels. But it certainly wouldn't be the spikes that we've been seeing, is what I understand. Not unless you've got a lot of new updates coming out and need to restart the whole mechanisms behind this. Is that correct?
I think I've lost you.
Can you not hear me? Okay, then I had some more questions for Noel. So I'll have to save them for another time, unless Noel can get his headphones working. But these are the sort of usual issues that happen with Twitter. So Noel is also responsible for, in Townsville, where Emergent Coding and Code Valley is based, is a town with a lot of BCH adoption. And this BCH adoption, so I see there that we've got Bitcoin Jason is one of the people listening. I don't know if Bitcoin, if you want to get on the mic and talk a little bit about the work you've done in the past. But Bitcoin Jason is also someone who helped with this, of getting merchants on board, accepting Bitcoin Cash in the surrounding area. And the idea behind this was, if you've got this amazing tool that's coming out and people can build their agents and people can build their machine code using this platform, and the backbone of that is Bitcoin Cash, then there also needs to be, it's much more valid if there's a market for Bitcoin Cash rather than these developers, agent builders, to cash out into fiat. And so Code Valley spent a lot of money in creating this market there of lots of different businesses all accepting Bitcoin Cash with the idea of trying to create closed markets. And this is why Townsville is now has been known as Bitcoin Cash City, and is sort of a pilgrimage for a lot of people that are in the community for a long time to travel there and to experience this, being able to use Bitcoin Cash on a day-to-day basis and in the stores you go to, if you want to have your hair cut or grab a Coke. So very, very interesting place. So I'm going to just remove Noel and then try and bring him back in, see if we can get one word on that. And tied in with that, so there has been a Bitcoin Cash conference way back in Townsville several years ago, and there was also another conference planned. Oh, here we go, Bitcoin Jason. There you go. Should be able to give me the mic. There's a Bitcoin Cash conference in Townsville planned later this year, which is the third larger Bitcoin Cash conference that I'm aware of that is happening this year. Hi, Jason, you're free to speak.
Oh, hi. Yeah, no, I love living.
How's it going, man?
It's going good, living the dream. Yeah.
Great.
There's nothing like going to work and just going through a drive-thru and paying in Bitcoin Cash. There's nothing like it. I'm a bit spoiled in a way because there's a lot of merchants here that accept it. And, the recent price pump was pretty good during the holidays. So I had a little bit of extra conversion that I can do. I got my ute fixed with it. Got new tires on the X5. Anything from mechanics to groceries, coffee, helicopter rides, that sort of stuff. It's quite good that you can plasterers, painters, lawn care people, all using Bitcoin Cash. It's a new cashy for the tradies. We've got a lot of builders. I'm being fair dinkum. I'm being fair dinkum because the thing about cashies, right, if you do a cashy as a trade, you're doing a cashy, you're doing it at a discount rate. So what the tradies do is if they do a cashy, they prefer Bitcoin Cash because they know that whatever residual that they have in Bitcoin Cash, they know it's going to appreciate over time. And so that's why a lot of tradies love it. And for someone like myself, having something that appreciates over time, if you use a trade, say you get your air conditioning fixed, you pay them in Bitcoin Cash, not only that you're getting a discount rate, getting the work done, but because the asset has appreciated over time, you get it at another discount on top of that. So that was the case.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
It's what it is. It's living the dream. And yeah, so no, I think you're back. So what I was just talking about while you're having the technical difficulties was just about the adoption that happened in Townsville. So there's a lot of Bitcoin Cash adoption. I don't think you heard. So what I was saying was that this was basically, this was done as a strategical shift so that to give an economical loop for people that are using emergent coding. So the financial tool, the backbone, has been Bitcoin Cash. So there's, for people, rather than having to cash out into fiat and go through that particular issue of, using exchanges or whatever that is, that they can just actually go and use their Bitcoin Cash that they've earned and spend it in the garage, in the spa, for the hairdressers, in the local shops, and so on. So it basically gives even more boost to this ecosystem. And I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that or about the efforts you've been doing as part of Bitcoin Cash adoption around Townsville, or as I've let everyone know, is Bitcoin Cash City.
Certainly, it grew out of being a huge fan of Bitcoin Cash or crypto. I felt a need to give back to the community because essentially, you know, I'm getting to use the payment layer for free. Like it's an extraordinary capability, and it was just created selflessly by Satoshi and all the folks in the Bitcoin Cash community. So I felt that, you know, I'm as a company, as a corporate entity, we're going to use this as a payment layer for monetization. And I wanted to contribute back to the community. And gosh, you know, we've moved on from that now to a point where, you know, it would make so much sense for Australia to adopt Bitcoin Cash as legal tender. You know, just think what an efficient currency and payment system would do for our GDP, you know, and international trade, you know, all that exchange rates and corruption and so forth would go out the window. You know, it would make so much sense to and be quite smart if Australia could be proactive and be one of the first nations to adopt Bitcoin Cash. There would be huge advantages to the first nation. I wouldn't want to be the 150th nation to adopt Bitcoin Cash, for example.
Yeah, and with regard to that, so I can highly recommend the book Free to Choose by Milton Friedman to understand just why that would be the case. So, you know, by not having these exchange rates, which are hugely manipulated by central banks of the various countries, which causes huge resource allocation mismatch and therefore like a quite a significant decrease in our wealth. So just having this currency, you know, a lot of people still think about coins in their wallet, but essentially that database is just distributed everywhere. It's essentially, you know, and it's a ledger, just like beads, and you're just moving beads across to different accounts. So, you know, you don't have that. There's no borders for Bitcoin Cash. There's no exchange rates. And the most important thing of all is there isn't a government that can use monetary policy that can, you know, inflate the currency and everything else to distort the market. So, you know, it's not just all of the middlemen you're cutting out, which is a huge boon, you know, all those banks, all those people that involved in the exchanging currencies, which is complicated. If you look at the back end of changing the Australian dollar to the American dollar to euros, it just removes it all and allows that price information to travel unimpeded. It's clean. It's basically the highest signal it can possibly be, which invariably leads to a lot more wealth creation. So as I said, Free to Choose is one book. There's many out there, also Rothbard, to delve into that concept, which is really interesting, and why a lot of people are very interested in cryptocurrency as a whole. Yeah, I'm not sure if you wanted to talk at all about the conference. So I know that, you know, that you're organizing a Bitcoin Cash conference in Townsville later this year. Is that something you'd be interested to sort of go into any details, or is that something you'd rather say for another time?
No. Look, I would thrilled. I think it's important to mention it. I think it would be wise. The conference is slated for late August this year. We haven't posted the tickets yet. We didn't want to step on any Bliss toes, and we did want to wait until Buenos Aires, Argentina, had posted the outcomes of their conference. So the way is open now. So we are proceeding to post the ticket prices, and the theme we are super excited about. As you mentioned, the Bitcoin Cash City has a very high level of adoption, and the mission of Bitcoin Cash is to become money for the world. So essentially, it's every city needs to adopt Bitcoin Cash, not just our city. And the city is at one level in the mission. You know, the nation becoming legal tender of a nation is also part of the mission. Every nation has to make Bitcoin Cash legal tender if it's going to be money for the world. So the conference theme is this one of legal tender. And Australia does have a quite a nice, enviable history of getting things right. You know, we were one of the first nations to decimalize our currency. We did before the UK, for example. And we were one of the first nations, you know, as a nation, we were created through consensus, where the six states got together and said, hey, let's do this. And, you know, we became without a war, without any kind of civil unrest, we became a nation. So there are these kind of points in time where Australia's kind of got it right. And we should now, with the advent of sound money, we've never, as in the history of the earth, had sound money, something this good. And so we can, move the government representatives of the people by adopting Bitcoin Cash. We have now at our disposal sound money for the first time. And so we would like to proactively, just like we did with decimalization or with metrication, it would make great sense for us to show some leadership again with the, adopting legal tender in Australia, and to show other nations that it's possible, and just how good it is for that role. It would be extraordinary if a country like Australia were to adopt Bitcoin Cash for legal tender. You know, I would.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think this would be massive. So, as we've talked about this. This is something that I think would be a game changing. So I know that a lot of libertarian or anarchist people within the community are very skeptical of legal tender, because it's the idea of asking permission. And I always challenge that, because it's not about asking permission. Anyone can use Bitcoin Cash, whether there is a legal framework for it or not. It's permissionless, right? Nothing can stop that. But the point is that for your, law-abiding merchant that wants to accept Bitcoin Cash, so as you as a Bitcoin Cash user, you want more people to accept Bitcoin Cash. And many people want to be able to stay within the realms of the law. They don't want to go to jail. They don't want to risk tax avoidance. So they want to be able to pay their taxes. And that's a real pain in the ass, to be quite blunt about it, today, because you accept Bitcoin Cash. All right, the price is continuously changing. Do you sell it now? Do you sell it later? But the point of entry when you are paid is when it's going to be taxed on, which means if the price goes down, you might end up owing more tax than it's even worth, theoretically, if something was to go really wrong, right? So being able to pay taxes and be able to pay your VAT or whatever it's called in your own countries, the value added tax on that good or service. If there's a legal framework for you to be able to pay for that and send that money either automatically or easily via transfer to the government or tax collection agency, this would make it much easier for companies to be able to accept Bitcoin Cash. It makes their financing, the accounting infinitely easier. And I'm a great believer that the only way that Bitcoin Cash, and it's the only way that Bitcoin Cash will become a global used currency by the world, is when there's no friction. And tax is a friction that needs to overcome. Whether you're pro-tax or against tax, it's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant because many people do need to and want to, whether willingly or not, doesn't matter. They need to pay that tax to be able to accept Bitcoin Cash without a lot of friction. So I think that's a really great movement, what you're pushing for, Noel. I'm looking forward to being able to hear if you get any of the local politicians or mayor involved in this from Townsville, because it's the kind of initiative that can, it takes a grain of an idea, but it can easily sprout into something really meaningful to the benefit of Australia, if you would manage to pull that one
certainly off. Our conference in 2019 was the first cryptocurrency conference ever to walk the talk, and we did leverage our merchant our local merchants that our high levels of merchant adoption so that delegates could experience the future of money while they were here. We've got 3.5 times that number of merchants today, and we're expecting to increase that number by the time of the conference. So it'll be a unique experience where people can experience that the future of money. And this big mission is like, it's mind blowing that we have sound money. And you're making a great you're making a great point about the local merchants and industry, but what about balance of trade? What about international trade being, you know, in a common currency? It's like the EU, you know, with the euro, but now at a global level, and with a money which doesn't favor, you know, nobody can print it, so nobody can abuse it. You know, one of the advantages of fiat is that, you know, it can be printed, and that has certain advantages to the host nation. But if we're going to share it, it's like everybody using the US dollar, but only the US can print it. You know, that's not a level.
Exactly. And this is the important thing. It's like game theory, right? Not a level playing field. It has advantage to the country that's doing it, but all countries have this possibility. So then everyone loses. And it's also, you know, so currently it's a way. So the US dollar, if you want to buy oil, if you want to buy gold, it has to go for the US dollar. So the US has done this amazing monopoly on the global currency. And so they can send the dollars around so that, you know, they can use their dollars to buy goods. Because at the end of the day, money is worthless. This is the important thing. It's only what you can buy with the money that has value. So they send paper, this you know, useful thing for real goods, and the idea is it's a promise of, you know, you're buying a TV from Japan or a car from China, and it's a promise that you're going to be able to get a dollar's worth of goods from America at a certain point. Now, of course, that might be going, you know, the Chinese might be buying it from Europe or whatever, but essentially at the end of the day, that dollar will have to be transferred for something from America. But that in the case of America, the Fed can print out more dollars, meaning the purchasing power of that dollar goes down, which is how they actually manage to export debt around the world. And it's not just America that does this. It's just they're the largest foreign money that's used to get as a global currency. But all countries play in this game, and it's actually detrimental to everyone's wealth. So, yeah, even though it's an advantage to that one country, in the end, it disadvantages everyone. So having something like Bitcoin Cash being used as the global currency will literally make everyone wealthy. That's a good pitch.
Yeah, and it's one of the things I like about emerging coding using Bitcoin Cash. It's an industrial use case, and it's, you know, it's leading the way, showing other companies that they can rely on this payment technology, this community, this governance model, you know, and it just needs somebody to show them, right? So, yeah, look, I'm looking forward to you know, reporting some outcomes of emergent coding, hopefully at the conference, and of course, you know, its theme of legal tender. That is a huge theme. You know, that's where we got to be, right? That's where every nation has to be. It starts at your local corner shop, your city, and your nation. Every nation has to proceed. So let's give it a go.
And someone has to start.
Yeah, that's it.
And someone has to push for that start, and that's you. And I'm really happy to hear that. So Noel, of course, you know, I know you're a very busy man. You have a conference this summer, you mentioned already. So there is another conference, BCH Bliss, which is taking place in May in the EU in Slovenia, the capital city, which is Ljubljana. And, you know, what are the chances that we'll be seeing you or any representative from Code Valley joining us? Because you just to sort of pitch it a little bit, you mentioned some key people in the industry. You said you're a supporter of XT. You're a supporter of Bitcoin Unlimited. And I'm sure you're well aware Peter Risen is going to be at BCH Bliss. So one of the founders of Bitcoin Unlimited, very, very smart guy. And he's going to be showcasing. He's actually on the panel. He'll be giving a speech about his hardware that he's using for scaling UTXO, which I imagine is something that you would find incredibly interesting. So, yeah, what are the chances? Is there any likelihood of seeing you or someone from Code Valley joining us this May in Ljubljana?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, we are discussing it right now. If it makes sense, if we've got reportable...
Of course it makes sense. What stupid question is that?
If we've got something to report, that'd be good.
This is the most awesome people in the Bitcoin Cash community. That's, and we've got, you know, the general protocols are there. We've got Peter Ryerson's there. And listen, you know, if that doesn't set it, no, I'm going, right?
Yeah, no. yeah, just wanted to point out one more thing. You know, as coming back to emerging coding in this components market, we've built the market with, you know, with the market, if you will. So we actually have very good coverage of Bitcoin Cash style software. There are thousands of these components that are dedicated to supporting Bitcoin Cash software, constructing Bitcoin Cash software. As you'd imagine, each agent must accept payments and make payments to a supplier. So it has a wallet, has these payment channels, these smart contracting, holy smokes. So I think, you know, from the community's perspective, there is a lot to offer, not just as a vanguard for industry using Bitcoin Cash, but one of the very few types of software we can actually create with Emergent Coding is actually Bitcoin Cash type software. So there is this advantage that we are bringing to the community, not just in its use as a payment system or putting economic activity on the blockchain, but one of the very few types of software we can create from the get-go. We need component coverage to create any kind of software. And one day there will be millions of components for sure. But from the get-go, because of our need to build a system with the system, we have had to support Bitcoin Cash components. And so hats off to Aptisio, our tech partner, who've created thousands of Bitcoin Cash components. And I certainly would love to see them at the Bliss conference. That would be fantastic to have those guys there.
Yeah, and it's exactly the conference for those guys. You know, BCH Bliss is for everyone, and everyone who's interested in Bitcoin Cash is heartily invited and will be very welcome there. But the primary purpose of Bliss is for the builders. It's for, you know, people showcasing what they're working on, people's ideas, and looking at where, you know, they're going to be focusing their energy on in the future, so that we can also improve the network, the ecosystem, the user experience for everyone that's already in the ecosystem, and also to attract more people into it, because to reach our goal, there's still roughly 8 billion people who need to be adopted to this amazing currency. But Noel, it would be fantastic if you would be able to join us at BCH Bliss. I don't know if you've been to Slovenia. I've only been once, and it was for the conference. I mean, I can genuinely say, as someone that has spent a lot of time in some of the nicest places in Europe, it's a really beautiful city. It's like Austria, beautiful hills, forested, very clean, and you can also spend Bitcoin Cash in quite a wide range of shops. I'm not sure how it compares to Townsville in its adoption. It's not Bitcoin Cash only, it's Alipay, so they accept a range of cryptocurrencies in most of many of the point of sales, which, you know, I really appreciate your stance. It's you accept all cryptocurrencies as long as it's Bitcoin Cash. But it does mean you can spend Bitcoin Cash. You can actually pay for the hotel in Bitcoin Cash. It's a Sheraton, so it's very nice. You can pay for the beer there, even the taxi to the airport. So, which I think is a critical part, right? You can't have a Bitcoin Cash conference anywhere, in my opinion, in good faith, unless you can pay for at least most of the way in Bitcoin Cash, which is possible. So I'm sure if you were looking for a little holiday with your wife, then Slovenia is a good place to come to and spend some time.
Sounds like a plan.
Fantastic. This up. So Emergent Coding. Noel, when have we got a public release?
We're in the process of bringing up what we call the G29s. This is the version that we want to take to market. We do have another version with some more of the roadmap features in the works, the G30s. So our plan is to bring up this market it pretty much immediately, and it just stays up. So that's going to be the early stage of the launch. We'll invite specific developers to give it a go. And once we are confident of its scaling and so forth, we will release the Kraken. We'll open it for a public launch sometime. Yeah, it's looking pretty good for this year, but you know, it's a very large project. So it's taken an enormous amount of effort. Yeah. So like John said, you know, like I can't give you any dates, but yeah, no, I would love to have something very reportable for Bliss and something, you know, that even more significant for the Bitcoin Cash City conference later this year.
Okay, so fingers crossed for a 2025 launch of Emergent Coding. It's been a long time in the making. And yeah, I've been, I think the first time we spoke was early 2022, which was when I was first equated to this project. So it's very excited to see this being released. Thank you so much for joining today, Noel. That was really fantastic, really informative. I hope the audience also enjoyed this. For all your listeners, please make sure to follow Noel and Code Valley on Twitter at Lavissa Noel and Code Valley 42. Respectively. For all of your listeners as well, if you enjoyed the show and want to show your appreciation, please feel free to drop some BCH or a Fiendish token into our wallet. Cash Token's address is in the description of the Twitter profile, and there's also a QR code in the comments. You can also find links there to codevalley.com, which I advise, you know, for all of you who found this interesting, go and check it out. And you can follow the news there. The next episode of Fiendish and Friends is in 2 weeks. So next week, unfortunately, the guest who we had who's going to be coming back on, we've rearranged it, but couldn't make it for next week due to a moving. So the next episode will be in 2 weeks at 4 o'clock Central European time, and it's featuring a Bitcoin Cash Rockstar developer, Jason Drezener, who was behind the Cash Tokens Upgrade 2023 and also responsible for a lot of the work and the chips in the Velma upgrade this May, which we'll be celebrating at Bliss 2025. And he's coming on to talk about his work in the ecosystem, the chips that he's already created and is working on, and what's next for Bitcoin Cash. So just make sure to pop some Fiendish tokens into the jukebox, hit play to convert tokenized Fiendish time into 60 minutes, 120 minutes, however many minutes it takes of the best Bitcoin Cash news and podcasts. This was Fiendish and Friends. I wish you a good morning, good day, and good night. Take care, everyone. Bye.